Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
As many of you know, we have a racing stable, Jungle Racing. This is not a huge operation, but we do race, we do breed, and we own some retired racehorses. On top of that, and in no way does this influence my take or how I see this, but I do want to be fully transparent about this. Some of the people that we are closest to in this business, Thoroughbred Racing, are involved with the winner, Country House. Ellen J. Foxwoods is Jamie Roth and her parents, and they are very good friends of ours. They're partners. We do business with them. We own horses with them. We have other projects with them. The Roths are big, big players in that sport. The Roths and we share the same bloodstock agents, Alex Solis and Jason Litt, who also happen to advise the other owner of Country House. And the other owner of that horse is Guinness McFadden and his family. Guinness has a farm in Kentucky, and he has one of our retired horses, one of the first we ever bought in Gallatin's Run. So if you follow us, you know the game. You remember that horse. So I know all these people. I do business with all these people. I consider them friends. Good friends. So I want to be very transparent about that. And before any of you try to say, hey, Rome, the only reason you're saying what you're saying is because you're partners with those people and they benefited from the inquiry. Wrong. Don't bring that around here. Don't come with that. I just want to be very transparent about all of that, who we do business with, who we're partners with, and who own that horse. So you know. Having said all that, do you remember when Omaha Beach had to be scratched from the Kentucky Derby? And it felt like maybe some of the buzz had gone from the Derby. Yet, neither do I, because that was the craziest Derby ever. That's not an exaggeration or a bold statement or a hot take. That's a damn fact. If you've been living under a rock for the past week or so, here is how the finish went down.
Maximum Security continues to lead the way. Midway on the far turn, he's a length and a half in front. War of Will is second. Long Range Toddy third, and four wide and moving up is Country House's Booty Express plummets through the field. And here comes Code of Honor, and he bursts through an opening on the inside of Maximum Security, and they're into the stretch. Country House on the outside. Code of Honor down toward the rail. Maximum Security keeps on fighting. War of Will is there too as they come to the final furlong. It is Country House on the outside. Maximum Security, so dead game. He keeps battling on. Maximum Security. Country House 1-2 down to the line. Maximum Security wins the Kentucky Derby. And then it was Country House second, followed by Code of Honor third. And in behind them, Master Fencer, who was closing.
All right, so that's an absolutely amazing moment. Maximum Security goes from running in a $16,000 claiming race in December to winning the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May. Amazing. Except that was not the finish, because instead of the results going official and Maximum Security going legend, it went to a review. Two of the jockeys, Flavian Pratt aboard Country House and John Court, who had been riding Long Range Toddy, claimed that they had been fouled by Maximum Security. So then everybody waited in the rain, in the mud, and they waited, and they waited. And then finally, nearly 22 minutes later, you get this.
They disqualified him.
They did. So for the first time in the history of the Kentucky Derby, the horse that crossed the line first has been disqualified. After the objection, Country House wins the Kentucky Derby with Flavian Pratt at 65-1.
You think you should have stayed up?
I don't know.
Maximum Security taken down as the winner. Country House moves up and wins the Kentucky Derby, and it's absolutely insane. For the first time in 145 runnings of the Kentucky Derby, the winner was taken down. And as you can imagine, fans at Churchill Downs and online went ballistic because of all the money that was riding on that. And then you want another kick in the junk. Not only did Maximum Security get taken down as the winner, he got bumped all the way down to 18th behind the lowest horse that he impacted. So that cost him, that group, that owner, nearly $2 million in purse money, and who knows how much more potentially in the breeding shed. And his owner is none too happy about that, which I'll get to in a minute. because I know the feeling. I was involved in something similar to that. But let's go back to Saturday really quickly. There are so many people that only watch horse racing one day out of the year, Derby Day. So many people that only bet that sport one day out of the year, Derby Day. So what happened during that race is extremely confusing to people who don't know and don't watch that sport. I get that. You would not believe how much time and money I spent before I finally started to get a really good feel for the game itself. So there was a lot of confusion after the race. Let me try to clear some of that up for you right now, although some of you do not want to hear this. But as usual, racing got some of that right and they got some of that wrong. In terms of the decision itself, they got that right. They got the decision right. And it took a big brass set to do it. The horse that finished first had never been taken down in the Kentucky Derby. And now, judging from the reaction, you can see why, right? Not to mention the stakes involved. Again, that decision cost the owners of that horse nearly $2 million in prize money, and who knows how much more money if the horse goes to the breeding shed as the winner of the Derby. Not to mention all the millions that were lost by those who bet on that horse. That said, the stewards got the decision right. It was the right call. Here's why. Maximum Security, the horse that was running up front, crossed over multiple lanes and clearly impeded and interfered with multiple horses, mainly War of Will and Long Range Toddy. Clear as day, if you see the replay. And it did impact the outcome of the race. It might not have been intentional. The horse may have been spooked by the crowd or something else, but in this case, intent really does not matter. There's no doubt. The horse veered out multiple lanes or paths, interfered with, and bothered other horses. Not the eventual winner, but others, and it impacted the outcome of the race. Listen, nobody ever wants to take the Kentucky Derby winner down. And believe me, I've been in a similar situation with Shared Belief in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to take the Kentucky Derby winner down, but in this case, the stewards got the decision right. That's a foul. And if it's a foul on a Wednesday in Kentucky or anywhere else, it's a foul on the first Saturday of May in Kentucky at the Derby. They got that right. They got it right. But they got a number of other things wrong. The call was good, the execution was not. As an example, based on what happened and how it was obvious to anybody who knows, the stewards should have immediately thrown inquiry up on the board, but they didn't. And the only reason is because an inquiry is because there were two jockeys who did. That's the only reason why they had it. But they should have done it themselves, and they didn't. And I'm not sure why that is. They didn't do it except to say maybe they didn't want to be involved in the outcome or maybe they didn't want controversy on the biggest day. I don't really know, but they should have done it themselves. See, the problem is, with all these angles and all that contact, very clearly the inquiry was in order and the steward should have done it. And the fact that they didn't is all kinds of wrong. Bad optics. Makes them look bad. And so is the fact that they did not take questions from the media after it happened and only had one official come forward with a 106-word statement. Given the nature of the outcome, given the amount of money that changed hands as a result of this, you got to be a hell of a lot more transparent than that. Somebody's got to stand up and explain the decision and answer the tough questions. Again, right call, bad execution. And then the next thing is now, where do you go from here? Because that's not the end of that. The owner of Maximum Security, Gary West, is really unhappy. Really unhappy about it. He now says he's not going to run his horse in the Preakness. And he's going to file an appeal with the State Racing Commission. And I'm not sure I would rule out possible legal action as well. I understand why he's upset. Our group was in a similar, I'm not saying the same, but a similar situation with the Breeders' Cup Classic in 2014. Shared Belief, a horse that we owned in a partnership, was the top-ranked horse in the world, the favorite in the Breeders' Cup. A race, by the way, that has a bigger purse than the Kentucky Derby. If Shared Belief wins that race, and he was the favorite, that's a ton of dough. He wins the 3-year-old Horse of the Year award after winning the 2-year-old Horse of the Year award, and then he's a lock for the Hall of Fame. So big time stakes. If you remember that race, you know where I'm going with that. If you have not seen that race, you should dial that up right now. Go find the race on YouTube. 2014 Breeders' Cup Classic. Byron comes out of the gate, smashed into Share Belief, and not only that, but hammered another horse that was the speed in the race that we were counting on to set up the pace for us. Smashed into both of us. Then about 100 yards later, Share Belief got hammered a second time by a horse named Toast in New York. I could have argued interference. A lot of people were pushing me to argue interference. Even some members of our own team were saying, come on, man, say something, do something. But I didn't. I sucked it up. And get this, Share Belief, despite all of that, finished an unbelievable fourth. And two of the horses that finished ahead of him, he had beaten head-to-head already. And the eventual winner was the one who smashed into him. So I've been there. No, it was not the Kentucky Derby. And the thing that Gary West has that we didn't have, Share Belief was a gelding. So he was not going to go to the breeding shed. But I would argue that for us, and it felt like this to us, the stakes were just as high. We lost a ton of money that day. Our horse got banged up that day. You know, my take of that day was there's racing luck. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad. That day it sucked. It was hard to do. I sucked it up. Hey, give me a minute. I need a minute to talk to you about Johnny O. I need to talk to you about the tweener button. Maybe you've heard about that. If not, it's genius. In fact, it's pretty much saving mankind. Let me tell you about that. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. It's a hidden button. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. It's a hidden button between the second and third button, and it's featured on all Johnny O shirts. The tweener button is the first patented button to make sure that you're not too buttoned up and you're not too unbuttoned. Get it? It's a tweener button. It's in between. The hidden button solves the age-old second button dilemma. Do you button one or do you button two? Now you know. Every Johnny O shirt comes with their patented tweener button, so you always look perfect. It is a total game changer. Check this out for yourself. Use the promo code ROME and get 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com at checkout now through May 30th. That's 20% off the regular price button-ups, which come in a range of fabrics, patterns, and styles. And shipping is free for orders over $85. That's johnny-o.com, promo code ROME, and get 20% off that first order and free shipping on all orders over $85. That's johnny-o.com. Promo code ROME for 20% off your first order and free shipping on orders over $85. Go to johnny-o.com for your tweener shirt. Get 20% off. Check out the wide selection of shirts and other products ranging from polos to shorts to pants to swim and more. johnny-o.com. Tim Layden is my guest. Tim, thank you so much. How are you?
I'm a little worn out, but good, Jim.
I would imagine, Tim, what a weekend that was. I mean, there was so much for you and I to talk about. It's almost hard to decide where to begin. But if we go back to Saturday, what were you thinking, Tim, when you saw Maximum Security, a former $16,000 claimer, hit the finish line first?
He was kind of a wise guy horse all week, Jim. A lot of people, smart people, watched him train and said, you know, it's not the miracle that he's here as a 16 claimer. It's a miracle that he ever ran as a 16 claimer. Horse has got great action, looks super good. There were a lot of smart people that thought he was the horse to beat in the race, so that part wasn't shocking.
All right, so when did you first know that something was up?
Not till I watched the race in the paddock with Baffert, because he had three horses in. I figured there was maybe a 25% chance he'd win it, so it's a good place to be. We were leaving the paddock to go out and interview the connections of Maximum Security to see if he won the race, and we heard Travis Stone, the public address announcer, say that there's been an objection and the race is unofficial. That's maybe 2 minutes after they crossed the line. So, you know, right then we knew something was up. And you know, watching the race in real time, you knew that something rough happened, but something rough always happens in the Derby. Couldn't see how bad it was till you saw the head on, which was probably 4 or 5 minutes later for me.
Tim Layden is joining us. You know, Tim, we had an inquiry ourselves when Share Belief won the Pacific Classic, so I know how nerve-wracking that can be. Everybody watching at home had a sense of what it was like to be at that track during this one Saturday, but what's it like to be there in real time and see that thing play out? What were those 22 minutes like?
I mean, it's like nothing else that you can cover, because if you're covering a bad call or a controversy in some other sport, you're sitting in a press room or a press box waiting for an announcement, and the principal players are somewhere else. In this case, I got out to the track, and I was standing next to Bill Mott, and I was standing next to Jason Service and Luis Saez and Flavian Pratt, and you're right in the middle of it. You're part of the story, and you're standing in mud up to your ankles, and and the rain is falling, and the time is going by, and every minute seems like an hour at that point because, you know, you've been at the track. Usually these things come down in, three, 4 minutes, and 22 minutes was a long, long time. And as it went by, like Jason Service said to me, when it gets this long, you've got an idea that it's going to go against the horse that's being claimed foul against. But it was wild. And as a journalist, at the same time, the clock is ticking. You're thinking, now I got to get back to my laptop and write a story that's a whole lot more complicated than one I thought I was going to be writing.
No, it certainly was that, too. Tim Layden is joining us. Tim, is there any doubt in your mind that the stewards made the right call?
Not in my mind. And respect to the people who disagree, and there was a lot of money bet on that horse, and I put up a quote from Baffert this morning where he said the Derby is always a rough race and you can't do this. For me, the aha moment for me came when I got out on the track and I'm not sure what's going on, and then the replays are up on the big board, and anybody who's been at the track knows that they put up all the angles, and the first time they showed the head-on shot where you're looking up from the finish line to the turn, as the horse is straightened out, you could see Maximum Security come over. I wrote three paths in maybe 10 or 12 feet, but it could have been more than that. And if you're looking straight up the stretch, it looks like he goes straight sideways toward the grandstand. And, to me, with enough time spent at the racetrack, I agree with the people that said if that was the third at Los Al on a Wednesday, that horse would have come down before they got back to the finish line.
We're talking to Tim Layden. That's my take. Tim, I think that if that's a foul on Wednesday at Los Al, or that's a foul Wednesday at Kentucky, then that's a foul on the first Saturday in May. You don't swallow your whistle there. Let me ask you this. Why do you think, we know that the two jockeys initiated the inquiry, why do you think the stewards did not do so themselves?
Well, that's a great question, Jim, and it's a question that all of us had Saturday night in the press area at Churchill when we were told that the stewards would give us a statement, but they would not take questions. And the question I would have wanted, there's a couple questions I would have wanted to ask them. Number one is, were you getting ready to hit that inquiry light before the jocks claimed foul? And if not, why the heck not? Because it looked like, from their viewpoint up above the track, they had to see that something wild happened on that turn. And the second question would have been, to what extent were you thinking about safety and what might have happened behind that collision if War of Will and Tyler Guffalione, the jockey, hadn't kept that horse on his feet with everything that's happened in horse racing this year? Because, it might have just been a fall with a sore shoulder and a sprained ankle, or people could have died and horses could have died, and that's no exaggeration.
No, Tim, that is no exaggeration. And then I can't even imagine where that would leave the sport should that have happened. You mentioned him. I'm curious, the one got the worst of that, but he did not file an objection. Why do you think that is?
I haven't talked to Tyler yet. Nobody has that I know of, or not at length. We talked to Mark Cassie, who trains War of Will. And his take on it was that by the time Guffalione got off the track, he was pretty shook at what had happened. And Cassie also gave this weird explanation that he thought, it's not – I think the bottom line is they thought in those minutes – because, as you know, a jock has to claim immediately.
Right.
In fact, the claim of foul in this race, the first claim was lodged by John Court, who told the outrider that he was going to claim foul as they were galloping out around the turn. And I think that what Cassie, the trainer of War of Will, the one horse, and Guffalione, the jockey on the one, both thought was that the stewards would put up the inquiry light immediately. They didn't think they would have to claim foul. As it turns out, somebody had to, or there would have been no investigation at all.
Hey, Tim, I was going to say, what if? All right, so what if everybody thought, I'm not going to claim foul, they're just going to put it up, and then they don't put it up? What kind of conversation are we having right now?
Oh, I've had a couple trainers say to me that, if they didn't take that horse down, nobody's talking about this race. I disagree super strongly with that. I think maybe initially that's the way people would have reacted, again, because that horse was, at 9-2, he was a second choice, so millions and millions of dollars bet more on him than Country House. So maybe that would have been the initial thing. But once that head-on shot gets out and people started seeing replays of War of Will's front feet in between the legs of Maximum Security, I think there would have been blowback, later that night or the next day. That would not have gone... It would not have been ignored. There's just no way. And it's just astounding to me that the stewards didn't put up an inquiry light. And in fact, Jim, we were told yesterday, Bill Mott, who's a trainer of Country House who won the race, he had to tell his jockey, Flavian Pratt, to get on the phone with the stewards because his other jockey on his other horse said something really nasty happened out there. I think that horse has got to come down. So it was really a whole bunch of really serendipitous things fell into place to even change the result of the race.
God, it is so wild and so complicated. We've got Tim Layden for a few more moments. You mentioned Bill Mott. You know, Tim, it's not obviously a way you want to lose the Derby, and I'd even argue that it's kind of a strange way to win the Derby. And I've been very transparent about this, Tim. I know all the connections. When I say that, I do business with the connections, and I want to make sure that everybody knows that so they don't think that my opinion is colored. But the owners of this horse, we are partners with on other horses, and Alex Solis runs that group. So you talk to Bill Mott. How does he feel about this? Like, he finally won his Derby. He's a Hall of Famer, but how does he feel about that win?
What he said yesterday was, I feel bad for myself, for Flavian Prott, for the owners, that I have to apologize for winning the Kentucky Derby. But he said, I'm not sorry for winning it because I feel like the call was right and the right thing was done by the stewards. But it's just a really weird way to win the Kentucky Derby. And something I wrote and Bill said also is, people are going to be talking about this now for long after we're all gone, and not necessarily for all the right reasons, but that doesn't change the fact that the right thing was done. And that was Mott's stance, and he said it on the track before they announced the decision. Same thing you and I were just saying. If that's the eighth race at Aqueduct in January, that horse is down. And he feels that a standard has to be applied to the Kentucky Derby as well, even though Baffert and some others have said to me that, no, it can't be in the Derby. It's a different kind of race, and you got to let it go.
All right, so that's Mott's reaction. What about Gary West, the owner of Max Security? He's saying already, I'm not going to run in the Preakness. He wants to file the appeal. He's making noise about not ever running again, period, and getting out of the game. What do you make of his reaction?
When we first talked to Gary after the race, he was pretty much saying this is the way the game goes. He's been in it a long time. I think people got in his ear and started telling him that he should do something. And also, he asked the stewards at Churchill to see the replay and hear their analysis, and they declined to meet with him until Thursday, which is when they go back to work at Churchill, which I feel bad about because I think that if the stewards just sat him down and said, here's what we saw, here's why we did this, we're sorry, you're good for the game, but this is the right decision, I think he might have walked away at that point. And he's going to wind up walking away eventually, Jim. I mean, the last time someone did this was in 1968 when Dancer's Image got DQ'd for a drug violation, and his owners fought it for 5 years and then ran out of money and walked away. You're not going to beat the house on this one. He can afford good lawyers, but the language is pretty clear, and the foul is clear. So, I mean, I feel bad that it's going to go on. I don't think Gary West is going to get out of the game. And I hope he doesn't. He's good for the game. But it's unfortunate. But he's going to lose this one.
Tim, I know how that goes, because when Cher Belief got slammed into coming out of the gate, you're in shock when it happens in real time, and you try to process it, and then as time goes on, you're right. People do get in your ear. People get in your head. People are telling me, why are you saying nothing? Why are you doing nothing? Why don't you do something about this? So I can see how that goes. A final thought, it's quick for those who don't really know. Tim, they rush in and they say, there you go, another black eye for the sport. Now, Todd Pletcher spoke to you. He's got a vested interest in the sport, but he thinks this actually might be a positive for the game. What did he say to you, and do you believe that?
Essentially, he said it was the biggest stage and an incredibly tough decision for those stewards to make, and that's why it took so long, and that's why they seemed like they were incredibly nervous when they talked to us. But what Pletcher said is, on the biggest stage in sports, unlike some other sports, we got it right. And the obvious comparison is the Saints-Rams game, where they didn't get it right and had no recourse to correct it. In this case, and they've been using replay in racing, as you know, Jim, for decades. It's not a new thing. And Pletcher's view was, this is painful, this hurts, nobody wanted to see this, very tough on the stewards, but under incredible pressure in what is by far the biggest horse race in the United States, we got it right in the end. And also, Jim, again, the safety thing cannot be overstated, because if we're talking about dead horses and seriously injured humans today, that's a much blacker eye than whatever people might be saying right now.
Tim, I'm not sure. I mean, let's be really honest about this. Had that happened like that, I'm not sure what's left of that sport in this country. If something like that happens on that big of a stage, then I don't know where that leaves you or us or any of us. You have to maintain the safety and care in that case. He is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and NBC Sports essayist, a friend of the program. Tim, you've done it a long time. I know you've had some crazy weekends. That one's got to be right near the top. So I really appreciate you coming on this morning.
Yeah, great, Tim. Thanks.
Listen, we're all in a hurry. Maybe you're running late. I know it can be frustrating. But you ever find yourself at a railway crossing waiting for a train? And you're ready to roll and you can't see the train? The signals are going. The train's not even there yet. So what do you do? I'll just sneak across the tracks. That is a terrible decision. Don't ever do that. Trains are often going a lot faster than you expect them to be. They cannot stop. Even if the engineer hits the brakes right away, it can still take a train over a mile to stop. And by that time, what used to be your car is just a crushed hunk of metal. And what used to be you, well, better not think about that. The point is this, you cannot know how quickly the train is going to arrive. The train can't stop even if it does see you. The result is the worst thing ever. If the signals are on, the train is on its way, and you need to remember only one thing, you need to stop because trains can't. Heading into Sunday's game 4 in Philadelphia, everything was trending the Sixers' way. Like Vegas could not move that point spread fast enough. Game 4 opened up with the Sixers, a home dog, getting a point in their own building, but by the time they tipped, Philadelphia was laying 3 at most of the betting windows. Some of that was Pascal Siakam and his busted up calf. Some of that was Kyle Lowry and Marc Gasol busting up rims. But the rest was the Sixers. Philadelphia dominated game 3. Joel was dropping windmill dunks and airplane wings. The Answer and Meek Mill were partying hard courtside. The crowd was hyped. Philadelphia's bench was going off. Even another hero game from Kawhi was not enough. And when a point spread tips the way Game 4s did, somebody knows something. And that something felt like the inevitable. 5 straight Raptors teams bowing out in round 2 or earlier. Half a decade of Toronto squads bullying their way through the regular season before getting the hands come playoff time. And just when it looked like the Sixers were about to wrap their hands around the Raptors' neck and put them in the ground, the King of the North looked death in the eye and said, "Not today." Toronto 101, Philly 96, and Kawhi freaking Leonard infinity. That game right there is why Masai Ujiri made that trade. That performance is why the Raptors were willing to risk everything. With Toronto on the ropes, desperate to avoid a 3-1 hole, Kawhi gets that team on his freaking back. He carries them back home with a 2-2 split. 43 minutes, 39 points on only 20 shots. 14 boards, 65% from the floor, 71% from outside. 5 assists, lockdown D. Like, if you had told me that Kawhi loaded the bags onto the bus, I would have believed that. Now, if you told me he jumped in the cockpit and he flew the team plane back to Toronto, I'd believe that. Because that was an everything performance. That wasn't just one guy on 5. That was one guy on an entire city. Through 9 games in the postseason, Kawhi is shooting nearly 59%. This series, he's averaging 38 a game on 62% shooting. If it sounds freaky, it's because it is freaky. Only Mike has averaged more than 35 on 60% shooting in a series. That's it. Just Mike. Kawhi's 21 of 24 on open looks. He's almost as deadly with a hand in his face. Single team this guy, double team this guy. Hell, whatever, anything, whatever Brett Brown throws at him, Kawhi seems to have an answer. And with the Raptors holding on to a 1-point lead, with just over a minute to go, and Kawhi had both Ben Simmons and Joel in his face. The shot clock winding down, he rolls around a screen, he steps back behind the arc, and he lands an absolute dagger from distance.
Gets a Gasol screen, now working on Embiid, 3 in the air, good! Down the bottom of the well for Kawhi Leonard, 94-90 Toronto, a big shot by Leonard.
Raptors radio with that. I mean, you want to talk about brass. This guy had to work through 6'10" Ben Simmons to get to Joel Embiid, a dude with a wingspan of like 14 feet, and still didn't blink. And then post-game, you didn't hear Philadelphia players or coaches complain about the refs or blame themselves for missed opportunities. They just tipped their freaking hat. Listen to Jimmy Butler.
He's a really good player, and he's been doing that for a long time now in the league. He's done that every game of this series. So, I don't know what else he could do.
Tobias Harris said, it's not about what we didn't do. It's about what that guy did.
You know, all the shots that he's taking are tough, contested, but he's a heck of a player, and he's making tough shots. So, we got to just continue to be physical and show a crowd and limit his touches. That's the biggest thing.
And then they got around to Brett Brown.
You know, Brett Brown
went with the ultimate compliment. He compared Kawhi to the Mamba.
You know, the stuff that he can get off, and we had two people out there, the stuff that he can do to create his own shot is Kobe-like for me. You know, he's just so gifted in relation to doing that. That's a hell of a player. 39 points, and you really felt all of them.
That's exactly right. Like, we did everything we had. We threw everything we could at this guy, and it didn't matter. He got his. It's a hell of a player. You tip your hat. So I respect all three of them and what they said. But better than anything that the three of them said was this dude from the cheap seats at the Wells Fargo Center. Per The Athletic, this is what one fan was screaming at Kawhi as he was lighting that joint on fire. Quote, weirdo! Weirdo! You're a weird guy! Weirdo! You're a weird guy! Yeah, well, that weirdo just sent that series back to Toronto, tied up 2 games apiece. That weird guy is doing it better than maybe any perimeter player has ever done it in the postseason. That weirdo is stone cold and dead-eyed. He might be weird, but he's not afraid. He might be weird, but he's not afraid of Toronto's past. And he's not worried about their future. He's just taking everything that the Sixers throw at him and dishing it right back, even colder. Toronto loses that game. The series is over. But they didn't, because that weirdo would not lend them.
Let's get weird.
Weird is good. But nothing's better than that. Arturis Karnišovas is my guest. Arturis, it is very nice to have you on the program. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you. Thanks for doing this. Now, if you take me back to Friday night in Game 3, I'm curious, what's going through your head when you watch that game go from regulation to one overtime after another? What was that like?
Well, it was an emotional roller coaster. We were all tired emotionally. We probably could have won 4 times, and we lost 5. So it was an amazing game. It was great, to be part of it. Unfortunately, it's sports, and somebody has to lose.
You know, it's so well said. You could have won that game 4 times, but you lost 5. When you get into something like that and you go that hard and you come up short, we can get to the individual performances in a moment, but what's it say about the mental and physical toughness of your coaches and players that they lose a game like that in Game 3 and they bounce back less than 48 hours later and they win Game 4 the way they did?
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. We did, similar. We went down in the San Antonio series to 1-2 and come back like this in the fourth game with after such a, Nikola played 65 minutes in that game, and other starters played from 45 to 50 minutes. It was amazing comeback. It just tells you about our team's resilience and mental toughness. We actually this year in back-to-back games we had 13-1 record, which is on the second game, back-to-back. So it's a mental state that actually you got to win those games. And that was demonstrated yesterday.
That was amazing. You mentioned Nikola, Arturis. I'm going to ask you about him in a minute, but Jamal Murray had 34, 9 rebounds and 5 assists in 55 minutes on Friday night. Then he comes right back with 34 last night, including 11-11 from the line. I thought he was amazing. What did you make of his performance?
Well, he likes challenge. he's again another one that is resilient. He's 22 years old. I mean, he was amazing, hitting those key free throws late. That, you know, that pretty much sealed the deal at the end.
You know, I thought you made a great point about Nikola. Let me switch to him quickly. You said, quote, he's an artist. If you ask famous painters, how did you do that? They say, I just did it. It's the same if you ask Nikola. He has a hard time explaining. He just does it and it happens. End quote. Now, you're an international legend. So are there moments where you watch him where you're also amazed by what he does?
I'm amazed. He's 24. He's, I can announce, you know, he's the best passing big I've ever seen. And then again, you ask him how he did it, and he just answers, I just did it. I don't know how, but, you know, it's not like he's working on it, but he's just, he's an artist there, and the stuff that he does every game, he does something something new.
You know, he would say the same thing about you, that when he was coming up, he used to watch you. Like, do you remember the first time you saw him? What were your thoughts the first time you saw him play?
Well, you know, it was, you know, to watch a player like this, you know, is just awkward, right? Not athletic guy, a little bit chubby, but his passing ability, his shooting, his feel for the game, his IQ was amazing. So, I mean, that's the first thing that we saw when we saw Nikola. Did we know that he's going to be that good? No. I can be honest with you, and it's just amazing every time you watch him play. He's an amazing player.
Arturas Karnišovas joining us. He is the general manager of the Denver Nuggets. Listen, I know you don't want to make it about you, but I think your story is so fascinating. When you were growing up in Lithuania, your father, of course, played professionally. What was he like as a player, and how early did you get hooked on basketball?
Well, I grew up around basketball. You know, Lithuania is basketball's number one sport by a mile. And my dad played, so I was around in gyms and, you know, locker rooms and training camps. So I grew up that way, picked up the ball when I was six, you know, and went through, you know, that Lithuanian basketball school system until I was 18. Played for, you know, Soviet Union cadets and juniors, and then got a chance to come and play college basketball in the States. That was my journey.
I want to ask you about that, but the story goes that you used to borrow a VCR to watch videos of finals games between the Lakers and Celtics. Is that story true, and what do you remember about that?
It is true. You know, when you know, Americans had a chance to watch it live and to watch it televised or going to see the game live, we were borrowing VCR probably 2 or 3 months out after the fact, and watching those games over and over again. So that was special. I think it was like my first games were when I was like 13 or 14 that I saw.
Incredible. I'm glad that story is true. So then you mentioned your dream was to come here to play American college basketball, and you work your way up. Your name is mentioned to PJ Carlissimo, who offers you a scholarship without even seeing you. At the time, nobody from Lithuania or the Soviet Union in general had ever played college basketball in America. What was it like to get the offer to play at Seton Hall?
Well, it was amazing. And, you know, I was 18, oblivious to a lot of things, but, you know, that dream to come to the States and play college basketball was there. You know, I didn't know what to expect. I had to start from, you know, from zero and, you know, proving myself. And actually, you know, we traveled to Moscow, and I had to wait in Moscow for 3 days that, you know, I'll get a go-ahead that I can go to the States and go play college. So that was intense times, and I was the first one to do it. And actually, after I came and played, it kind of opened the doors for the rest of the guys. And, you know, more and more players were just start coming in and playing college basketball.
Well, and that's a much longer story, too. You were there for 3 days, and the KGB was involved. So that had to have been a really intense time. And the story goes there's basketball, but then there's, like, the culture as well. Like, the story goes you did not speak any English when you first arrived in the U.S., and you didn't see your family for 18 months and communicated primarily through letters. What was that time like for you and your family?
Well, luckily for me, I I was very good in math. So math saved me until I was proficient in English my first year in college. So I took all the math classes until they told me that I couldn't take any more because I had to specialize in math. But, yeah, that's how I survived. I took a lot of English classes that didn't count for graduation and got pretty proficient in 1 year and then took English 1 and English 2, which helped me then in the third and fourth year to actually do pretty well in school.
That's incredible. Now, your parents were also getting letters saying that if you did not go back and join the Army, that you would go to jail. That seems incredibly scary and emotional. What was that time like?
It was scary. It was scary. I couldn't go back for 3 years. And even when I went back and after my sophomore year, before we played in Barcelona Olympics, I was kind of scared for the first 2 weeks in Lithuania. You know, are they going to come? Are they going to take me? So it was scary, emotional. You know, after my first year in the States, at times I would get on the phone and actually speaking to my parents during the coup. You know, when mom looks through a window and, you know, counts tanks. You know, those were intense moments. Mm. So those are the memories.
Artūras, let me ask you about the legendary. You were part of the legendary Lithuanian Olympic teams at the 92 games and the 96 games. As a team, you had to battle to qualify for the 92 Olympics, and then you faced a dream team. So now you're going up against guys that you grew up watching. You're guarding Charles Barkley. PJ Carlissimo is on the sidelines for the U.S. team. What was that experience like?
It was amazing. You know, sophomore out there, running around, you know, playing against the, you know, legends. And actually, I fouled out that game because I had to guard Barkley unsuccessfully. And, you know, and we lost, I think, by 45 that game.
Right.
So it was amazing.
What about Chuck? What do you remember about that matchup? Was he talking to you very much or just doing his thing? What was that like?
I think he was talking, but, you know, he was just such a, you know, hard player to guard. I try to play power forward, and I had no chance against Charles. So,
now, you beat the Unified team, and you won a bronze medal for a nation that had just become free. How special was that for you and the team?
It was amazing. We had a, you know, Lithuanian president at that time, you know, at the game. And after the game, he came to the locker room. We put on tie-dye shirt, you know. So, you know, champagne was flowing. So that accomplishment was my probably most special accomplishment in my career.
So, Artūras, finally, I'm listening to this, and I'm amazed by all of this. I knew your background. I know your story, so this is not new, but I'm amazed just to hear it. You've had an amazing career as a player and an executive, but you don't strike me as somebody who's looking to take credit for anything at all, but you really are a pioneer when it comes to international players coming to the U.S. So how much pride do you have in the fact when you look around the league and you see guys like the Joker having a tremendous impact on the sport, how much does that mean to you?
It means a lot. And, you know, with players coming and, you know, playing in our league, and now it's probably 120, I think, international players playing in our league, and including executives like, you know, Masai and Vlade Divac and Sean Marks. Those are international execs around the league. You know, it's amazing times now.
It is. He was named GM in 2017. The Nuggets in a fierce battle. That series is tied up at 2 games apiece. Artūras Karnišovas, my guest. Artūras, so nice to meet you. So good to have you on the show. And I really appreciate that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. All right, so if you missed last night's Game 4 in Philadelphia between the Raptors and Sixers, I just gave you a whole take on it. But if you missed the take and you missed the game, don't worry about that. In fact, don't even bother with a highlights package or a recap blog, because in my hand, I am holding the definitive take of all takes. And in just 38 miraculous words, you'll know everything there is to know about the series tying dub that the Raptors ripped at the Wells Fargo Center Sunday night. Sure, I did a whole take on this. Sure, I talked about Kawhi. However, there's a guy who's much better equipped to do this than me and way more succinct. You know me, I can get kind of rolling for a while. This is the take to end all takes. This is the most definitive take. Prepare to have your mind blown. Are you ready? Quote, I don't know who will win the series with Toronto's victory over Philadelphia to even it up, but I do know that Kawhi Leonard has been dominating the series and put on a show today, scoring 39 points. Holy crap. He went there. I don't believe that guy said that. Man, that is so good. That is so accurate. Man, that is mind-blowing. That is chillingly succinct and precise. Wildly intelligent. And who do you think thumbed out that Pulitzer Prize-winning tweet? You already know. It's Irv. Irvin Magic Johnson. Who the hell else? Who the hell else? Quote, I don't know who will win the series with Toronto's victory over Philadelphia to even it up, but I do know that Kawhi Leonard has been dominating this series and put on a show today, scoring 39 points. I mean, I read that a second time. It's even better than the first. Rest or rust? Absolutely no rust factor whatsoever in this guy's Twitter game. Welcome back, Irv. I can see why you quit your gig as president of the most storied franchise in NBA history, because that is a fire tweet. Now, I've got no idea how any of us went 2 years without that kind of content in our timelines. Speaking of quitting the gig, up until this weekend, nobody had heard from LeBron on Magic's sudden and shocking departure from the LA Lakers. I mean, wouldn't you think that the face of the franchise would be one of the first to go on record about his boss trading in his office key for his Twitter password? Especially since Irv was the one who inked up Braun to that 4-year deal less than 10 months ago. But it turns out that LeBron, the basketball player, was hoarding content for LeBron, the TV producer. And on Saturday night, everybody's HBO Go account was worth more than just an East Coast feed of Game of Thrones. Because for the first time since Irv abruptly shut it down with the Lakers, LeBron finally got around to giving his side of the story on his TV show, The Shop.
Magic stepped down. What was that?
How did you find out?
Yeah, what was that process
like? Out through him.
You found out Magic stepped down through him.
Yeah, he came locker room.
Yeah, and I found out from Randy.
Between my stretching session, my right hand comes to me and say, Magic just stepped down. And I'm like, man, get the out of my face. You bullshit. I go check my phone. I look at it. The happened. Personally, for me, I came here to be a part of the Lakers organization, having a conversation with Magic. So it was just weird for him to just be like, I'm out of here. And not even have no like, hey, Bron, kiss my ass, I'm gone. It wasn't even that.
Yeah, but it was different for me. Like when I was like, that is crazy. And I took a minute and I was like, yo, Kuz, what are we doing tonight?
That's wild. So LeBron's been sitting on that. Yeah, now I know why. You think he's going to share content that good for free? You think he's going to give that content away? You think he's going to give that away? Hell no, he's got a show. So he waited. According to LeBron, he found out that Magic was quitting from Randy Mims, his longtime business partner and assistant. And LeBron didn't believe it right away until he checked his phone and he saw the breaking news along with everybody else. I love the whole notion that Bron is checking his phone like everybody else to find out what Irv is doing. And I really like what he said, that He didn't come to him and say, yo, Bron, this is what's up. Or didn't even come at him like, hey, Bron, kiss my ass. This is my decision, and this is what I'm doing. He just didn't come to him at all. So even though LeBron was not playing in the season finale when Magic dropped that bomb, he was still in the building, and he walked into the locker room with the rest of the team to see what was up. LeBron also said on this week's episode of The Shop, quote, no one had any idea. We was all like, damn, right now? It was literally 70 minutes on the clock. I'm not playing, but my team is still playing, and you kind of decided to do that right here, right now. I feel like there's a time and a place for things, and I believe you knew you were going to make that decision, so why would you do that here? Why would you do that now? End quote. Good questions. Fair questions. Why there and why then? I'm pretty sure everybody is still wondering why the president of the team quit right before the final game of the season without telling anybody at all, only to leave the squad and the head coach and the face of the franchise completely stunned right before taking the court. But according to Magic, at that time, he had to quit right then and right now. Otherwise, Jeannie Buss would have talked him into staying. Remember, that's what he said then. Hearing that now sounds even dumber now than it did then. Oh, I had to do it. I couldn't tell her. She would have talked me out of it. Listen, when the guy who left the entire city of Cleveland dangling by their heartstrings, live on TV, only to take his talents to South Beach, thinks that your exit is tone deaf, then you know you botched it. And Magic did. But we knew that already. I didn't need LeBron to question Magic on his TV show to know that Magic jacked that whole thing up. What's far more telling, again, is that LeBron aired it out and aired out his former boss on his TV show. And he's doing it with Lonzo Ball as his guest. Magic's biggest draft pick and Magic's biggest free agent signing are on HBO, presumably getting paid to crack on Magic. Instead of talking to the media right after it happened, LeBron skipped the exit interviews and taped Saturday night's episode 2 days later instead. Again, why give away premium content for free? Think about that. Instead of going to the presser, he went right to the TV set and he sat on that episode. Had that thing in the can for like a month. And the first time any of us are hearing from LeBron on Magic is on LeBron's TV show. And again, he was pretty good on it. Wish I'd heard that back then. But content, man, everybody's got to feed the beast. And that's what these guys do now, right? I see them working. They're holding their own content. They'll release their own content when they want to. Kobe never did. MJ never did. The Hick from French Lick never did. But then again, that was then, and this is now, and the world is totally different. If you thought LeBron trying to trade the team to New Orleans was a power flex, what do you call this? My man's like Jackie Moon out there, player, coach, GM, and now team correspondent. It's incredible. Why talk to the media when you can collect a check from HBO to do it right there? Why talk to the media when you're the player, the coach, the GM, and the media? Man, what a year for the Lakers. Six straight years without the playoffs. LeBron's first significant injury. Magic quit. Walton fired, and now the face of the franchise is out here burying ex-employees and franchise legends on HBO a month later. 1 year down, three to go, can't wait for next season. And it's got nothing to do with basketball. Car flags up, Laker honks. Car flags up. Car flags up. Ryan Hollins is my guest. Ryan, what's going on? How are you?
What the heck is going on, brother? How have you been?
Man, so good. So good. It's only been five days, but I'm great. How about you?
I'm doing good, man.
Good. All right. Let me ask you this. The Sixers get blown out in game one of their series with Toronto. Then they come back and they win game two on the road. Then they blow the Raptors out in game three. Then Kawhi saves Toronto while Joel was clearly sick. In your mind, where is that series right now as it goes back to Toronto tied up?
This is why you play for home court advantage. Two teams are evenly matched, decently, in the sense that you want to give Toronto the advantage as far as chemistry. And even though Kawhi Leonard is new, the way he plays the game, he fits into any system, dudes. I mean, seriously, it's a seamless transition. Philadelphia has the talent, but there's not enough time for them to really develop. And obviously, you're always going to point back to the very talented Ben Simmons. But you know Ben Simmons isn't built for the playoffs. His game does not fit the way you play in the playoffs, even though he's incredibly talented. So Philadelphia has things that they're working out. And right now, Jim, it's going to come down to coaching and home court advantage.
Ryan Hollins joining us. Go back to Ben Simmons, Ryan. So he's had three straight games at 10 points or fewer. Look, I understand that scoring is not his only way to contribute, but from Philadelphia's standpoint, they need more, right? So in your mind, why is he not built for the postseason?
Well, he can't shoot off the bounce.
And the one thing, I was in the league as a defender, so I had to study scouting reports. So when you build a scouting report, he's a very easy guy to guard. You guard Ben Simmons, you want to keep him from playing downhill. That means attacking the rim. You're going to go under on all screens. And essentially, you can be a help defender because I can recover back to him. He's not going to beat me from like by shooting a deep three. So now he gets in everybody else's way. So he was my X factor for the Eastern Conference playoffs. Why? Because he's a guy that he scores between the 17 to 20-point range, and now you have to guard him. With his passing ability, Jim, he makes everybody better. And if he's not putting out the point production, and I understand that coaches put the ball in Jimmy Butler's hands because Jimmy is a dual threat. He can score and he can shoot from the outside. But Ben Simmons has to score in that type of range because he's infectious when he's playing well. You saw it against the Nets. Jared Dudley challenged him. He went off and blew out the Nets. But his scoring is a game changer for the Philadelphia 76ers.
And right now he's not scoring. Ryan Hollins is joining us. He's a 10-year NBA vet. All right, so Ryan, how impressed were you with the way Denver showed up in Game 3 and then came back after that 4-overtime game to win last night in Game 4?
Look, man, I'm flat out saying I didn't see this team going anywhere. I thought they were fortunate to get out the first round. But the one thing that's in their favor is their youth. What I mean by that, they're not getting beat up by playing a 7-game series. They don't know to be tired. They don't know any different. And those young guys are getting experience every single game that they play. So hats off for them to find out how to win games. But the biggest question there is inconsistency. What Jamal Murray shows up? What Gary Harris shows up? Who's going to be there when the games get tighter and tighter? Because, Jim, from game one to game two, 3 and 4, 6 and 7, those are completely different ball games, the way the referees call them, the way the players play, and the intensity changes. They haven't been there before. I'm not a believer in Denver, but I cannot do anything but take my hat off and salute the way those guys have been working and growing. I get it. I love what Mike Malone is doing.
I do, too. I do, too. That's a great series. I'll get back to the officiating in a minute. Ryan Hollins is my guest. Go back, Ryan. I'm jumping around here, but go back to Game 3 of the Bucks and Celtics. What do you make of the way Giannis showed up in that game?
I thought he was consistent. And this is a two-edged sword right here. This is a two-edged sword, Jim. I want you to come with me.
I'm here
this
for you.
This is the reason that you attack the rim and you play downhill. Because if the referees are going to call it tight, you're going to have a field day. He's unguardable. But in the playoffs, normally those are not fouls. The way he was playing, normally the referees let that go. You can hold guys a little more. You can grab them. You know, you can do all the little things. And he got a very favorable whistle. Now, if that whistle changes, you get a couple stops on Giannis, the game completely changes. Kyrie was fussing about that third quarter, and deservedly so. You're playing on your heels. Now you can't defend. Now your hands are tied. But credit Giannis. You play downhill, you attack the basket, and in moments like that, good things will happen. And I thought his supporting cast was excellent. Bud made adjustment after adjustment. And you know what? Guy after guy showed up. Where's George Hill been all season? You know, where was Brook Lopez in game one and two? But those guys showed up big as a supporting cast, and Giannis fed off their energy.
Ryan Hollins, my guest. All right, so when he's playing downhill like that and he's attacking the rim every single time, forget about it. There's almost nothing you can do. And then, Ryan, to your point, you have to adjust. If the referees are going to call it a certain way, you got to play it a certain way, but you never know how they're going to call it. So what do you expect the refs to do for game four tonight?
Well, for one, Boston has to put on their big boy pants. Because the one thing I know about having experience in the playoffs is you got to have experience with referees. How the heck are they calling a game? Sometimes it's tight. Sometimes you can grab and hold. Sometimes your position defensively has to be perfect. You have to be able to adjust. Secondly, Boston was very sloppy with their help side defense. What do I mean? This is one of the most athletic teams in the league. They can help on the rim. They can get back. When Giannis spins, he should be seeing 2 and 3 defenders and have to make a tough pass out of the blind side of his eye. So those are adjustments they have to make. And you have to credit Giannis. The one thing that he does is he plays downhill, as I said. Most guys go downhill. I'm a right-hand driver. I'm a left-hand driver. Or I go right, you cut me off, and I spin. Giannis has a little bit of everything. Euro-step right-hand, Euro-step left-hand, spin move, up and under. He's got it all heading to the rim. He just has to develop that outside shot. But one thing I love about that kid is he's working on it. And no, Jim, he is still not my MVP, just so you know.
Good. I was going to ask you that, but now I don't need to. Ryan Hauntz is my guest. Ryan, one more thought about the officiating. I hate wasting a lot of time on this, but just bottom line this for me. When you hear guys complain about the officiating, do you understand that and that they're setting things up for the next game? Or would you rather these guys just stop complaining and just play the game?
Jim, I've always been honest with you. I don't hold any punches. When you play in the NBA and in the playoffs, you have to assume in your mind before the game happens that you're screwed. If you have any other thought in your mind, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. I remember going into a Game 7 playing against the Miami Heat on the road, and we knew we weren't going to get a call. And guess what, Jim? We didn't. Obviously, the Heat going to win it, and they win their, I think, second championship or first whatever with LeBron, whatever, should have been mine. But nonetheless, we knew we weren't getting a favorable whistle, and we played through it. I've seen Dwayne Wade literally jump on Rajon Rondo and slam him to the floor. Referee, no call, play on. You don't have time to cry. You don't have time to complain. You have to play through it. And put in your mind already, you're not getting a whistle. You've got to take it. And that's why I do credit Giannis for playing downhill and attacking the basket game after game. He could have been a little more passive after game one or game two and said he didn't have the same success. But guess what? It showed through, and I do credit the kid. I don't think he's the sole reason why they won. He's got his work to do, but he did his job.
Ryan Hauntz is joining us. Ryan, before you go, game four of Golden State-Houston tonight. Defensively, it seems like Houston's plan is to prevent Steph Curry from taking threes. They're forcing him to go to the basket. It worked in game three. Does that seem sustainable to you? And when you look at Steph right now, what do you see?
Let me break this down to you, Jim. When you play against great players, sometimes your best defense is your offense. And they're picking out wherever Steph Curry is, and they're making him have to slide his feet. Guess whose page they're taking it out of? I don't know if you thought this would be happening. Listen, they're playing like the Los Angeles Clippers. The Clippers had a lot of success attacking Steph Curry, going at him, drawing fouls, keeping him on the bench. He never gets in a rhythm. And guess what? This is the darn truth. As good as Kevin Durant is, as great a scorer as he is, he doesn't make anybody better. So when the ball is in Kevin Durant's hands, you know who gets worse? The rest of the team. And they end up losing the ball game. Am I blaming KD for being KD? No, but guess what? Steph Curry's used to having the basketball in his hands. This is a tough transition for him, especially a guy who's getting beat up on the other end of the floor playing defense. So it's an interesting dynamic with the Warriors. I still have the Warriors. My heart says Rockets go ahead and win, but my head says Golden State is going to show up big. The one thing they do well is they adjust, and their chemistry is like none other. Steve Kerr can put in a game plan hours, minutes before the game, even at halftime during a game, and those guys go out and execute it seamlessly. They know where each other is blindfolded. They don't even have to talk or communicate. They know where they're going to be.
Ryan Hauntz, my guest. Now, Ryan, off the top, I mentioned you are an entrepreneur with Mama Cinch, but we've got to give credit where credit's due. Your wife, Jan, is the one who started Mama Cinch. Lay it out for me. What's it all about? How did it first come to be?
So, Jim, me and you may not know anything about this, but we know we need to take care of our wives. So just know this. The pants are amazing. What does every woman want to have, essentially? A better figure. They tighten up your legs, give a little plumpness to your butt, help circulation, and you look amazing wearing the pants. They are addicting. Oh, and I forgot, they tighten your waist, too. So that's what these pants do. Jim, this is not for me and you. This is for the missus, for the significant others. Mama Cinch pants, go check them out.
Bro, it sounds too good to be true. Where can people find out more info?
Check it out on Instagram, Mama Cinch, MamaCinch. And they're also the website there. So, Jim, I'm expecting you to purchase a few pair of those, or we'll send you some, man.
You got it, man. You know it. He was a panelist on my daily TV show back in the day. I'm all for anything that creates a little extra plumpness for the butt. 10-year NBA vet, LA Clippers broadcaster. He is an excellent NBA analyst, and I said I'd bring him back, and I did, and we'll do it again. Ryan, great job. Appreciate you, and really well done.
My man, anytime.
My man. Talk to you soon, dude. Good job. Ryan Hauntz.
Good night.